Well, I don't know if you knew this, but it's summer. And a fun fact about Michigan, which I have a hunch that you know, is that, and really all of the Midwest, that in the summer, for the three short months of this long year, we are outside. Yes, we are outside. We're soaking it up. We're soaking up as much sun as possible as if we can, like, store it for the winter, like we're sun squirrels. And we're getting the fresh air, and we're getting mosquito bites, and we're taking evening walks, and we're watching out for the strawberry moon that just happened. And we're bird watching, and we're fishing, and we're playing in the water, and we're grilling as much as possible, because who wants to heat up the house? And we're still doing the things that we have to do, like working and doing laundry, because who wants to run out of clothes? But those things are not our priority in the summer. They're there. We're still doing it, and we're doing it well, but mostly. But our priority is enjoy the summer while it's here, because it's so short. And every season has its beauty, and every season is God's creation, and we know that, and we acknowledge that. But the season of summer is particularly good at calling us to pay attention to the beauty and the genius that we're a part of on this earth. So it seems like the perfect time for us to explore creation together, I think. Because we spend these months basking in the glory of a Michigan summer, it's really good to remember that what we're also basking in is in the glory of God, which takes us from summer to fall to winter to spring to summer again. That glory doesn't end. So for the next 7 weeks, we're going to be directing our minds and our hearts and our worship toward God the Creator by tuning into creation. Genesis 1 is where the story of creation begins, so Genesis 1 will be our guide through the next 7 weeks. And so we're just going to begin where we begin, which is at the beginning. Way back, Genesis 1, verse 1. Two verses we're going to begin with. And they may sound a bit different than we're used to. This first couple of verses is a more literal translation of the Hebrew that I find to be really helpful. So, Genesis 1, 1 through 2. In the beginning of God creating the heavens and the earth was confusion and emptiness. Darkness was upon the face of the depths, and the breath of God was hovering upon the face of the waters. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So after Eric and I got married back in 2014, we bought our first house when we lived in Holland. And we were really eager to get out of the townhouse we were in, to get a house that we could work on and a yard that we could actually garden in. That was so exciting to us. And that spring, we chose a spot in our backyard and we broke ground for that garden. And what we found was a lot more than dirt, unfortunately. We found broken glass, we found garbage and chunks of something black and rock-like that we weren't quite sure what it was. We had apparently picked a site that was once used for a coal dump, which made sense because our house was built in 1911, back when coal was the primary fuel source. And then at some point, it turned into a garbage dump. And then eventually dirt covered that garbage, and that's how we discovered it. So our garden site turned out to be kind of a small picture of these two verses of Genesis. It was full of confusion and chaos, and it showed no signs of life. There wasn't a worm to be found in this dirt. The soil was emptiness. There was no life. Now, the Hebrew phrase for that we find in Genesis 1 and 2 is tohu vavohu. Tohu vavohu. It is a play on words. The Hebrew writers said that a lot. Tohu vavohu, formless and void, confusion and emptiness. Tohu vavohu. Now, in those two verses, we find God hovering over the depths, it says, dwelling in that darkness, hovering over the confusion and the chaos and the emptiness. And the very breath of God hung over it and stayed present with the confusion and the emptiness, with the tohu vavohu. Now that means something, I think. It means that the chaos and the confusion and the emptiness had value and potential that just hadn't been realized yet. So most of us know how Genesis 1 progresses. That God creates and creates and creates in a way that only God can create, and then delights in that creation and what has been created at every step. And God brings purpose and order to all that tohu vavohu, to what seemed purposeless and orderless. And what happened over time in our little backyard that we had discovered was an undoing of that, it felt like, an undoing of the life that had been breathed into that dirt at one point. It had come undone. And that soil returned to a place of confusion and emptiness, full of garbage, empty of life. Tohu vavohu. But those first few verses of Genesis tell us something really vital as we encounter those spaces and those places and that kind of dirt. God doesn't abandon the tohu vavohu. God sees it, holds it, values it. God knows that it can be transformed. Hope is not lost in the tohu vavohu. What that soil needed from us was for us to see what God sees when God looks at tohu vavohu. Some garbage removal, compost, worms, it could come back to life again. All the possibility is there. There are some of us in this room who are staring down the tohu vavohu of this life. Maybe it's looking at the state of the world that we acknowledge often. Seeing the confusion, the emptiness, the chaos, it feels formless and void of hope. Maybe it's seeing the tohu vavohu of our country or our state or politics or whatever. The tohu vavohu of our own families and our personal lives, the chaos, the confusion, the emptiness. Sometimes our own hearts and souls feel like the tohu vavohu. But instead of hopelessness, what if we understood that God is hovering over our tohu vavohu? What if God is hovering over it? What if the breath of God is suspended right over all of it? Staying present with our suffering soil, breathing life over our struggling earth and our struggling hearts. What if that's what God is doing? Because what we can learn here in these first couple verses of Genesis is that God does not abandon the chaos and the confusion and the emptiness. God never says, there is nothing to be done here. That is not anything that God has ever said or done. Because God is present in all of it. And then God says, let there be light. Which brings us to Genesis 1. Verses 3 through 5. And then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light and that it was good. And God made a distinction between the light and the darkness. God called the light day and the darkness called night. God called night. And it was evening and it was morning. Day one. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. There's a Hebrew prayer that's part of Jewish evening prayer services, and part of it goes like this. Well, the beginnings are how most of these Jewish prayers begin. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam. That means, blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe. And then the evening prayer goes like this. Borei yom v'laila, goleil or mipnei choshek, v'choshek mipnei or. And that means, you are the creator of day and night, rolling light away from the darkness and darkness away from the light. It's a preparation for the darkness that night brings. They do this at an evening service. So as they walk toward the evening, they praise the God who rolls the darkness from the light and the light from the darkness. So over time, light has come to mean good, right? Light comes to mean good, and darkness has come to mean evil for most of us, or most of what we've kind of heard and learned. And the New Testament actually does this quite a bit. For example, in John, Jesus says, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." That's there. That's something that happens quite a bit through the New Testament. Now, comparing and contrasting light and dark can be a very useful metaphor for explaining or understanding something. Jesus isn't wrong for helping us understand who he is by using this metaphor. But as we often do as human beings, we take things too far. Usually do. For example, as we know, light skin has a long history of being perceived as civilized, pure, good, more godly even. Dark skin is then perceived as barbaric or uncivilized or immoral. There's an evil there. When the only way we understand darkness is something that needs to be escaped from or rescued from, when darkness is something that we learn to avoid at all costs, we can end up devaluing things that are dark against our even conscious minds. Maybe it's all subconscious, but it's there. We miss out when we do that. We miss out on half of what makes a day, when we try to escape the dark. Something really interesting that's easy to miss is that when God created day one, by separating light from dark, day from night, is that God did not banish the dark. God did not destroy darkness or banish it. The dark was not hostile or evil or threatening. The dark is what God dwelled in before God created light. And God does not dwell in evil or hostility. The light that God created was a counterpoint to the darkness. God created this balance between the two, the light and the dark. Both needed to exist in order for the earth to bring forth and sustain light. Both had to exist. And night isn't just some necessary evil. Dark, the night, it's full of life. It's full of life. Did you know that nearly half of the species on earth are nocturnal? I did not know that. Half. That means that half of the life on earth is dependent on darkness to go about their natural processes and for survival. Artificial light from things like airports and cities and even our street lamps cause light pollution, which disrupts those natural rhythms for our nocturnal creatures that we have in our world. Light is the bad guy in this situation. It's not really that easy to put those two against each other, is it? We humans obviously are not nocturnal. I mean, some of you maybe. I know at least one of you. One of you in this room is. Generally speaking, though, humans are not nocturnal. And we depend on the light to perform those activities for survival that we need to do. But even creatures like us need the dark. And some of you already know this, but I thought this was so interesting. This is from an article from the Sleep Foundation. It says, as evening approaches and the light in our environment comes down, the hormone melatonin begins to rise, our body temperatures fall, both of which help us to become less alert and more likely to welcome sleep. And with the help of the morning light, melatonin levels are low, body temperature begins to rise, and other chemicals and hormones shift, such as an uptick in cortisol occur to help us feel more alert and ready for the day. There's these natural rhythms and these ebbs and flows that are dependent on our bodies experiencing light and darkness. Light and darkness. The darkness is vital to our own rhythms of sleeping and being awake. And sleeping itself is also not a waste of time. We have come as a society to decide that sleeping is a waste of time. Let's get as little sleep as possible because we have to be as productive as possible, right? But when we sleep, our blood pressure drops. The blood supply to our muscles increase. Tissue growth and repair occurs. Energy is restored. Hormones that are essential to growth and repair increase. What happens in the dark is truly amazing, even if we're unconscious for it. The dark is a blessed space. Light is obviously equally as important to our bodies. We know that getting sunlight during the day increases our body's response to rhythms that they need to be responsive to. And when we get sunlight during the day, we often sleep better at night. It increases our vitamin D, helps our immune system, supports healthy blood pressure. But both that light and that dark are beneficial and necessary for our survival. Both of them are. There's a really wonderful book. I couldn't find my copy to bring in. I wanted to show you, but it's called Learning to Walk in the Dark by Barbara Brown Taylor. If you're looking for a book, and it's pretty short, it is just a magical, marvelous invitation to consider the blessings of darkness. So just wanted to plug that. I always love giving book recommendations. But we could set aside all of the usefulness that we find in the dark and in the light. We could put all that aside, and it would still be an amazing gift to us, because God also saw fit to make it all really beautiful. And God also saw it fit to make us people who can perceive beauty and appreciate it. The sights and the sounds of light and darkness, the sights and the sounds of day and night, the differences that we notice between the two. We love sunsets, we love sunrises, but we also love the night sky. We love the birds chirping in the morning. We love the spring peepers chirping at night. We love the butterflies by day and the lightning bugs by night. It's this perfect balance of light and dark on this earth is a matter of survival, yes, but it's also a matter of beauty and joy, which is something that God really loves and has created us to also love, beauty and joy. The ebb and the flow of day and night is what makes up our days. The waves of dark and waves of light are what make up our entire lives. Sometimes the night can feel awfully close to that tohu vavohu. I'm going to say it enough to where you all will remember it forever. Nights can feel really close to tohu vavohu. What we find in the light can also feel very close to tohu vavohu, chaos and emptiness, the confusion. But let's remember that there is no place that God is not. There is no place that God is not. God's spirit hovers and dwells even in the most desperately empty spaces. May we notice the way that God rolls the light back from the darkness and the darkness back from the light. There's one more Hebrew prayer I want to tell you. I should have put it up there. I'm so sorry. I will post these on our blog, actually. I think that it would be really helpful to do that. But listen to this prayer. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam, yotzer or uvarei choshek, osei shalom uvarei et hakol. Blessed are you, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who fashions light and creates darkness, who makes peace and creates everything. Today we come to the table of the Lord for communion. And that's a place where we see God continuing to create new things from the dust. We're reminded of the ways that God creates new things from the dust, life from death. It's a place where we see God continuing to bring order and form from the hopeless places, from things that seem so desperately gone and lost, like death. God manages to spring up life. So as we come to the table together this morning, I pray that we open ourselves to hope and wonder about what God is up to, even in the tohu vavohu, which I imagine is exactly how Jesus and his followers felt in the events that led here to this table.